Why am I choosing to write about this multi-front assault on our society, culture, families, and very way of life? Because I see it. I know where it is headed, and I refuse to choose to accept it. The 10 working principles for a healthy society. How to push back against the social media platforms. How to get your family strong again. You can get it anywhere books are sold on February 27th. The 10 working principles for a healthy society. Principle number 2, focus on solving problems rather than winning arguments.
It's possible to predict the outcome of a marriage, whether or not it's going to divorce, with great accuracy. And I'm not just saying that because I've got a really good eye for this. I just have this unique ability to spot things. There's actually been a fair amount of research done on this by some really good researchers. One of those is Dr. Gottman, and Dr. Gottman has been researching this for decades, and there's a marriage lab involved. There's all kinds of observation of couples, and longitudinal data has been collected to determine whether or not the presence of certain characteristics predicted who was going to get a divorce and who didn't, or other characteristics predicted whether somebody was going to get a divorce or they weren't. And across time, it's really been narrowed down to certain traits and characteristics that predict whether you're going to get a divorce or not. And I'm going to tell you what they are right now, and then we're going to talk about what to do about them. This has been derived from 7 different studies that Dr. Gottman has done. And these studies included all different kinds of couples, those that were divorced, those that remained together that were happy, and those that remained together that were miserable. And from these studies, Dr. Gottman found that couples that eventually get divorced tend to have conversations about conflicts with one or more of the following features. So I want you to think about these, write them down. They're going to be on the website, but you need to ask yourself, do I have one or more of these following features in my communication pattern with my significant other? And if you do, then I can tell you that you're likely to get a divorce, and I can tell you that with 94% accuracy. Now think about what I just said. If you do one or more of the 6 things I'm getting ready to tell you, research says there's a better than 9 out of 10 chance you're going to wind up getting a divorce. And that means one of 2 things. You either just ought to go ahead and get it now and save yourself the trouble, or you better change what you're doing. So what's number 1? Number 1 is couples that tend to wind up getting a divorce manage conflicts with what is called a harsh setup. Now, what we're talking about here is there is an obvious sign from the get-go, from word one, that this conflict is not going to go well because it starts with sarcasm and other negative forms of communication. That can be criticism or other expressions of contempt. And when I say sarcasm, it can be mocking the other person, mocking the way they talk, mocking what they say. It can be, you're just like your father. Oh, you're just like your mother. How does anybody ever respond to that? I mean, you're attacking their parent. So if it begins with a very harsh setup where there's sarcasm, mocking, criticism, character assassination, where whatever the issue or topic was, that has been pushed to the side. This has gotten personal, and there is an attack on the individual's character, worth, and value. People that do that in arguments wind up divorced 94% of the time. Number 2 are the 4 horsemen, and these are 4 forms of negativity that have been shown to be so devastating to a marriage that Dr. Gottman referred to these as the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. And these are criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. And by the way, they actually occur in that order. It starts out with criticism and then contempt for the other person, which draws defensiveness from the other person, and then they wind up just stonewalling. It's just like the garage door comes down, and now you're just talking to a wall. Conversation dries up. I got nothing to say to you. They shut down mentally, emotionally, physically, and typically withdraw from the situation. So the four horsemen are criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling in that order. So think about your conflict patterns, because it's not just that this happens once. If this has happened once in your relationship, or it happens once a year or occasionally, that doesn't mean you're going to get a divorce. But if these things occur in pattern, this is the pattern with which you communicate and deal with conflict, that's when you can predict that they're going to lead to divorce. So ask yourself, what's your pattern of communication with your significant other? Do you go at it constructively? Do you problem solve together? What is your objective when you have a conflict or a disagreement? You see, some people have a disagreement. They have an argument over we're going to do A or B, and their objective when they enter the conflict is to win. And you're probably thinking, well, of course my objective is to win. Why else would I be in this argument? Well, let's just unpack that for a minute. Let's say you get into an argument with your significant other, and let's assume that this person is your significant other because you value them. You love them. You care about them. You nurture them. You wish them well. But then you get into an argument and you want to win. Well, let's extend that out. If you're going to be a winner, what does that mean they're going to be? If there's a winner, there has to be what? A loser. Do you like to lose? So do you think they like to lose? How do you feel when you lose? You feel down, depressed, broken, resentful? I mean, I think about winning and losing because I grew up in athletics, and I remember walking down the hallway in high school, and if we were going to play the Titans, the signs on the wall would be, crush the Titans, you know, devastate the Titans, annihilate the Titans. So the idea was, you just wanted to stomp them into a mud hole. You wanted them to get on that bus with their heads hanging down, their tails between their legs, saying, man, they crushed us. We don't ever want to come back here again. They dominated us. Well, that's because it was a competition. And if when you have a disagreement with your partner, it becomes a competition, then there's going to be a winner and a loser. So, I mean, what are the banners in your head? Devastate Debbie. Dominate Debbie, trounce Debbie. I mean, is that really what you want to do? I mean, is this a win-lose situation? And then let me appeal to your greed. What kind of company is a loser? You win the argument, you dominate, devastate, trounce Debbie. Now you have the rest of the evening stretched out ahead of you. What kind of companion is she going to be? Is she going to be a lot of fun for the rest of the evening? Is she going to be real happy to be around you? I mean, you just stomped her into a mud hole. I mean, is she going to be like, oh, hey, let me sit in your lap. I so trust you with my feelings and emotions. Of course not. She's not going to want to be around you. And when she is, she's going to be defensive and shut down. She's going to stonewall you, the four horsemen. You say, well, then what is an argument if you're not going to try to win? What if instead of your goal to win, you make it your goal to be heard? H-E-A-R-D, heard. I want you to hear my point of view. I want you to acknowledge my point of view, and then you do with it as you will. And I will hear your point of view, and then let me do with it as I will. So the conclusion of this disagreement is going to be that we have heard each other. Heard, H-E-A-R-D, not H-U-R-T. I know this is audio, so I want to be clear. The objective is that we have heard each other. So if your objective is that you hear your partner and that they hear you, then you retreat. And across time, I promise you're going to find that if you truly love one another, you're going to get out of the combat zone and you're going to try to find some middle ground. where you can accommodate as much of what your partner wants as you possibly can, and your partner's going to accommodate as much of what you want as they possibly can. And that means both of you are moving towards the middle, and you're going to narrow the gap of difference a whole lot more than you think you can. And sometimes you'll do 75% of the compromise, and your partner will do 25. Maybe the next time your partner will do 75 and you'll do 25. But across time, you tend to find that middle ground where you find ways to coexist. You find ways to live together, whether it's differences about parenting, about spending money, about in-laws, religion, sex, whatever it is, you tend to find a way where you're sensitive to each other's position. But you give each other a face-saving way out of the conflict. You reflect on it. And, you know, later we're going to talk about how to fight fair, rules of fighting fair. But before we actually get down to tactics, we have to first talk about the strategic approaches to this. So you can see why the first two things that predict divorce are the harsh setup, sarcasm, criticism, contempt, and then the four horsemen, criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. The third of six predictors is called flooding. And this is a term that describes the overwhelming and sudden nature a partner's negativity can take, particularly in the form of them just blasting you with both barrels with character assassination, all of this contempt and criticism that they bring. Defensiveness can have the same effect, but this is when everything just goes off the rails, and it's just all-out war at this point. There's no consideration for the feelings of the other person. It's just all-out war at this point. They get so negative that it's just, get them before they get me. I'm going to nail this person. And so the character assassination just takes over as the number one objective. Number four is body language. Look, when somebody is the target of flooding, when they come under attack, and again, the attack is personal. It's character assassination. It is really to devastate them. Their heart rate is going to go up. I mean, it's going to go over 100 beats a minute. It's going to go as high as 165 beats a minute. Their blood pressure is going to shoot up. Adrenaline is going to spike. They're going to go into fight or flight mode. There's no problem solving now. There's no reasoning. They are in fight or flight. It's like, okay, put them up. We're going to have a verbal knockdown drag out here. Or I'm getting away from you. I'm out. I'm gone. Fight or flight. It's one of our most basic reactions. And that's what happens when you are attacked in a character assassination kind of way. The fifth of six that predict divorce is failed repair attempts. Remember I said this was a pattern? When I say it's a pattern, I'm talking about this has to occur overnight. Even as powerfully negative as flooding and the four horsemen, criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling are, they don't seal the fate of a marriage in one bad night. There has to be a pattern of this. And when there's a pattern, it has to be followed by failed repair attempts, where the person makes half-hearted attempts, insincere apologies, doesn't really come in and repair the damage that has been done. And failure to do so, failure to really come in and acknowledge what took place and how bad an idea that was, is a reliable sign that divorce is in your future, because the wounds never heal. And you have these open wounds. It's like your psychological skin has been burned. And so now it doesn't take much to offend the other person. It's just like you can come up and pat them on the back and they're like, oh man. They react because they're still hurting from the last time their character was attacked and assassinated. So failed repair attempts are a critical factor. And then number six, all you have to do is interview the two people in the relationship independently and find out if they have a backlog of bad memories.
The NBA playoffs are back, and on FanDuel, new customers can bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed. Back in the day, news like this, your crew would have been writing each other letters.
Dearest Benjamin, wonderful news from the East. The spread has been covered.
Or maybe you'd use your phone to actually call someone.
Man, you see that dunk?
Man, I saw that dunk.
But these days, it's all about the group chat.
I love that high-fiving kitten emoji.
No matter how you tell them, let your crew know that all new FanDuel customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed. Ooh, Morse code. Classic. FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Do they have a backlog of bad memories? Because if what sticks out in their mind, what they have in their memory bank, is one painful experience after another, it blocks out the good times. It's the big blow up, and then the next big blow up, and what happened at Christmas, and how things went bad on one of their birthdays, and what happened on over the 4th of July, and just negative, 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 negative. If they have a backlog of bad memories, that is a strong predictor of divorce. Look, no couple is going to have a success-only journey through their marriage. It just doesn't happen. Everybody is going to have conflict. Everybody's going to have problems. It's never going to be success-only. But couples who have more good times than bad, couples who have fond memories, tend to have a happy marriage because they relish those good times. And you've heard me say a million times, the best predictor of future behavior is relevant past behavior. So if your history is positive, your memory, your history in your mind is positive, then you predict a positive future. But if what you have in your head is a negative historical perspective, then you're going to predict a negative future, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the six things that predict whether you're going to get a divorce or not all have to do with how you handle conflict. Dr. James Kimmel Jr., a researcher at Yale University, we're addressing the adverse physical effects that anger and revenge have on the brain, and that the brain, therefore, has on behavior of some people. Research says that this anger, this retaliatory behavior, is just as addictive as opioids, making them extremely difficult to resist for some people that get into this loop. You're very active in this area, and it's not what you think, it's what you know. You've done a lot of research, so you come at this empirically, and that's what is so impressive about what you espouse about this. What got you so interested in this?
Well, you know, what got me interested in this was my own personal experience as a teenager, as I explained to you when we last met, you know, talking about this group of guys from my high school that came to my home one night, shot and killed my dog. And I had this very strong urge to retaliate against them. And I wanted to kill them as a result of that. I was able to overcome that at the very last second. I mean, by the time I stopped myself, I had a gun in my hands. But I wasn't able to shake the desire for justice that I was seeking. And you know, we have two meanings for justice. There's justice that's fairness and equity and righteousness, and there's justice that means retaliation and vengeance. And the one that I was seeking was retaliation and vengeance. And I couldn't shake it. I became a lawyer for it, and then I ended up paying a high price as a lawyer as well by spending a life where I was being paid to hurt other people. I mean, a litigator, a lawyer, is often being paid on behalf of a client to retaliate against, to hurt the person who hurt them. whether you're a plaintiff's lawyer or a defense lawyer and you're trying to defend that. But in either side of that model, it's really what it's about is that's socially acceptable retaliation, which is better than street vengeance. It's a step forward in human progress, but I believe we can go beyond this, beyond that level.
You say you did this as a lawyer and paid a high price for it. Did you think that you were in the loop that you've now identified as a lawyer? Did you get the payoff in the moment when you were a lawyer and you would exact that pound of flesh?
I sure did. I got it over and over again. And that, at the time, this is 15 years ago, I didn't understand what's happening to me, but I sure knew that every time I would win as something as simple as a motion or even an, you know, an email, you know, a pissing contest between lawyers, you know, that, and that's what happens. Every one of those gets you a little high or a little shot, a little victory, where you feel, you know, kind of high as a kite. And then you're left sort of feeling worse, but chasing it down again and wanting that hit again and again, you know, and again. And what was particularly fascinating for me is I was seeing this same behavior in my clients. I began to think that I was selling them a drug because they were willing to pay me ungodly sums of money to get these hits of pleasure as well. Every time I was able to, you know, inflict some pain or suffering on the other side, whether it was the other side's lawyer or the person that they were representing. As this progressed, it so conflicted with, you know, what my inner values were for as being a human being and starting to realize I'm being paid to hurt other people. That was a tough realization for me, and I didn't see a way out of it. And I felt very hooked into this lifestyle and into this mess. And this brought me to a point of such depression and despondency, you know, that I was, you know, I was considering suicide at one point. And this, that realization that I even, and this is what the thing was, I felt I wanted justice against me. I wanted revenge against me at that point. And that's when I thought, this looks like an addiction. This doesn't seem like normal behavior. This seems like what I knew from people who were addicted to narcotics or alcohol or tobacco. This seemed like that. But no, there was nothing in the literature. Nobody has ever was at that time, and only until recently, largely me, have figured this out and concluded that this is an addictive process. And that only came really from my personal experience of looking at addiction and seeing myself as an addicted person. And then, you know, God struck with this fantastic set of neuroscientists who have been doing studies at what's going on inside the human brain when somebody is harmed and they're retaliating. And to my amazement, the exact same brain structures and neural pathway that's activated for substance addiction is being activated or was being activated for somebody like me who's caught in this revenge-seeking cycle for pleasure. And that's what it's all about. When somebody hurts you, you retaliate for pleasure. You're trying to make yourself feel better from the pain of the grievance.
Now, when you say it's the same pattern as we see in addiction at a neurological level, we are able to see on fMRI, the same pathways light up that we see with addiction to heroin, opioids, whatever. There are certain pathways that we can see light up that involve the pleasure centers of the brain, the motivational centers in the limbic system, and all that cause people to seek this out again and again and again. And we've been able to see those same pathways light up with certain other non-chemical experiences. One of them is what you're describing here. So when you say it's the same neurological pattern, that's what you're talking about. And that's why I say this is empirical.
Right. There is empirical evidence now that we have that shows that grievance and revenge seeking looks like other behavioral addictions, such as gambling addiction, right. Sex, food, internet, gaming addictions, those things that are considered behavioral addictions. You're not ingesting a substance, you're engaging in a behavior. So we think about the definition of what is an addiction. An addiction is engaging in a behavior that is harmful to you and you can't stop doing it, right? That's a compulsive behavior that is harming you. Gambling harms you. Gaming ultimately can become harmful. And revenge seeking is the most harmful behavior you can engage in, because what you're doing is to gratify your lust for pleasure, you have to harm somebody else to get that. That's the most dangerous behavioral, and really the most behavior, it's even more dangerous than a substance addiction, because with substance addiction, the person that's most hurt is the addict who's ingesting the narcotics, and their family, of course, and sometimes the community can be ravaged by these things. But that's not at the same scale of world war. And it's not the same scale as nuclear war. We all know if the world ends as a result of a nuclear strike, that'll be because nations gave into their craving for revenge and they launched the retaliatory response, end of civilization. That's how dangerous this particular human behavior is. It's been part of our lives since Cain and Abel, but we're just now discovering why.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit, or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
With Kizik hands-free shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy-on, easy-off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Yeah, now, let me not put the cart before the horse too much. Here's the question. In your opinion, is this always dysfunctional?
No. So there would be an argument. And evolutionary psychologists and evolutionary biologists would make some form of argument that would say, look, humanity was selected into doing this. But some of the suggestion is, well, we were selected into becoming super predator revenge seekers, which is kind of what we've become here in 2022. We're just right. Getting better and better at being able to instantly measure that we've been wronged and retaliate with all forms of force, whether it's, you know, from a tweet to an AK-47 or, you know, an AR-15. And evolutionary psychologists would say, well, you know, maybe that's, we were selected into this through evolution as a process for helping to pacify. So in other words, to cause people in a society to form norms or follow norms, I should say, norm behavioring, which is to say keeping people in line, right? If there's somebody that's a bully running around, you want to stop the bully. You can stop the bully by retaliating against the bully. The problem with that argument, though, is that we know now that it's the desire for revenge that is driving the bully. So is it really an accurate way of looking at it? If natural selection had wanted us to be revenge predators in order to create peace in a society, it would have selected us to be forgiveness addicts, not revenge addicts. Because the people who forgive, who are the people in our society who are the best at forgiving the fastest and to do that repeatedly, are the people that are the least threatening in any society. And the most likely to maintain peace in their community versus people who are violent. Now, that doesn't mean, and I'm not saying, and I've had this question many times, I'm not saying that a person who commits a crime, a violent crime, shouldn't be incarcerated as quickly as possible while they present a threat to society. But I am saying that there's a different way of deterring that violence or preventing it. And that's now a public health prevention and treatment approach. And I'm glad in your introduction, you mentioned prevention. And public health is all about prevention and treatment, not just one or the other. And this is a different approach from only relying on prisons and law enforcement to work our way out of a dangerous, violent society. It doesn't work. It's failing. And we have to all acknowledge we have the best police forces, the most well-armed, the most surveillance we've ever had in society. We have all sorts of ways to be able to pound people into submission, but the pounding into submission isn't working. And just adding more retaliation from the government really isn't going to solve the problem. We need now more of a prevention and treatment approach from the ground up that says we're not going to just retaliate against people. We're going to show them how to manage these dangerous revenge cravings from youth. And we're going to, in adulthood, when somebody's at a risk, we're going to help teach them how to recover from their addiction just the way we do with addicts. Back in the 30s and 40s, back in Prohibition time and before, when alcohol and drug addiction was becoming a significant danger in society, the thought was these are people, these are moral deviants, and we need to use law enforcement to pound them into submission and pound this addiction out of them. And you know, as a psychologist, that doesn't work. You cannot law enforcement your way out of an opioid crisis, and you really can't law enforcement your way out of a violence crisis either. That's what I think we're going to have to come to reckon with in society is we're going to need more than just more cops, although we need more cops.
Dr. Phil here. Come February 27th, you're going to be able to pick up a book called We've Got Issues. And you know we do. This is a book that says it's going to teach you how to stand strong for America's soul and sanity. And in this book, I set forth 10 principles for saving this society from going off the deep end. 10 principles for protecting your family. 10 principles for giving you what you need to flourish and have the life that you want for yourself and for your children and for your grandchildren. We've taken some wrong turns. We've been letting the loudest voices dictate some of the thinking that has taken us way off course. Well, I'm speaking up and bringing us back to the center of the road. I hope you'll pick this book up, and I hope you'll read it with a real open mind, because I'm pushing back against a lot of what you've been hearing. Somebody had to do it. Might as well be me. February 27th, We've Got Issues.
Laura Nyreiter is a clinical professor of law and co-director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law in Chicago. Now, Laura represents individuals who were wrongfully convicted of crimes when they were children or teenagers. Her clients have included Brendan Dassey, whose case was profiled in the Netflix global series Making a Murderer, and Damian Echols of the West Memphis Three, whose case was profiled in the documentary West of Memphis. Dave Thompson is the president of Wicklander Zulawski and Associates, Inc. He is also a leader in non-confrontational interview and interrogation training. Now, he doesn't want to demonize police in any way, and like me, is a supporter of law enforcement. But there are some that abuse the system. Dave incorporated evidence-based investigative interrogation, which focuses on building genuine rapport, asking open-ended questions, and using academic research to train for investigative interviews. Together, they have a collaboration that, let's face it, is a bit unexpected. A defense lawyer and a law enforcement trainer, which they will also tell us about. I work with law enforcement as well, doing training and all, and I've been asked over the years so many times, is Stephen Avery guilty and is Brendan Dassey guilty? I've given the same answer every time, and that is, all I can tell you for sure is that neither one has ever had a fair trial. Don't know if they did or didn't. I can tell you what I think. What I know is they've never had a fair trial.
Well, look, I can speak only as Brendan's lawyer, but I've represented Brendan Dassey for 15 years now. and my work on his case and getting to know this young man who was 17 when I met him. He is 33 years old now. I am so proud to represent Brendan Dassey. The only evidence connecting him to this murder is this confession we're talking about, where he's not even able to describe what happened. You know, I mean, every citizen who cares about truth, who cares about due process, who cares about reliability in our criminal justice system should be jumping off their couches and, you know, rushing out there to make sure that this doesn't happen again, not to Brendan, not to any other special education student, not to any other kid, not to any of us, right? The way the system let that boy, now man, down is just heartbreaking.
Laura provided the opportunity for us a few weeks ago to chat with Brendan. And I think it's important for me to be able to say how kind and inspiring Brendan Dassey is. And I can't imagine anybody I've talked to. I know we had Terrell Swift on your show. Anybody I've talked to that's been kind of a victim of this process, it just amazes me the hope and the positivity and the focus that they have, because they know who they are and they know what they did or did not do. And just Brendan, just one of the most, the positive, most inspirational piece of this whole puzzle, I think.
Yeah. You know, he's 33, as I said, and, you know, Brendan has, I've watched him grow up, and he's grown up into this unbelievably kind, you know, gentle, funny person who still has, he still has this childlike faith that one day justice is going to come for him. You know, it's remarkable, after making a murderer, all these people around the globe, millions and millions of people saw his story. They started writing Brendan letters, right? From all over the globe. You'd get these letters. He still gets like 5 or 10 letters every day.
Really?
From ordinary people who just, you know, it's nothing profound or eloquent, who just put down on a piece of paper, "Hey, Brendan, you know, hang in there. I'm thinking of you. I believe in you. Hold your head up high. You know, the truth is going to come out." This kind of stuff. He still gets these letters every day. He keeps them. And he writes back to as many people as he can, you know, given his limitations. He writes back to as many people as he can, because those letters, you know, finding their way to his prison cell in rural Wisconsin, some from Australia, some from, you know, the other side of the country, some from just down the street in Wisconsin, those letters give him an enormous amount of hope.
Laura, what is next for him, and what's it going to take for him to get released, get reconsideration, get a fair trial? What's it going to take?
It's going to take courage, Dr. Phil. It's going to take courage. You know, if someone in Brendan's position legally right now, the best option is to go to the governor of Wisconsin and seek executive clemency. In this case, a commutation, which means a cutting short of a sentence, essentially an act that would free him.
So that's all that's left?
That's Brendan's, you know, best option right now by a mile. So right now we are in a process of education, of collaboration, you know, reaching out to folks around the state of Wisconsin. "Hey, have you heard about Brendan Dassey? Come talk to someone like Dave," right? A law enforcement authority who knows what he saw when he saw those tapes, who's shown those tapes to 50,000 cops around the country to train them. You know, come and just sit down with us, talk with us, watch this video, meet Brendan. And, you know, I guarantee once you approach this case with an open mind, there's only one right, decent thing to do, which is free Brendan Dassey.
And what is his sentence right now?
He was sentenced to life in prison with the first possibility of parole in 2048, when he will be 59 years old.
2048.
That's right. That's right.
Good God.
You know, and one of the amazing things, Dr. Phil, is because of all these problems with his case that we're talking about, during his trial, when he was on trial back in 2007, the prosecutors actually offered him what they call a mercy plea. No strings attached. Just say you did it. We'll give you 15 years in prison. Don't have to testify, nothing. Just say you did it, 15 years. He said, "No, I didn't do it. I want to go to trial. I want to get through this trial. I want to prove my innocence." Now, because he went to trial and was convicted, because people don't understand why someone would falsely confess, right?
Right.
Now he's got life in prison. He's done way more than 15 years. He's coming up on 17 years now.
Yeah, he would be out.
That's right. That's right. But he stuck to his principles and it landed him a life sentence.
Wow. That's sad. Nobody knows. But like I said, what I know for absolute certain is he has never had a fair trial, and he certainly hasn't had a fair shake. I'm having lunch this afternoon with Marty Tankliff. I worked on his case back when he was still in on trying to get him out. And as you know, he was exonerated,
Got
out, became an attorney, is now adjunct professor at Georgetown, and works on just these kind of cases and has a family. And you just hope when you give people the chance they deserve, you see what happens. It's just astounding to me.
No, it's what you were saying before, you know, the resilience that these folks show and the humanity that we're locking up wrongfully in these cases. Marty's a great example. Dave, you know Marty as well as I do.
Yeah, Marty's, again, another example of an inspiration. He's helped testify in some of these legislative hearings to get policy change. He's been a great support. And I think, you know, if we go on just real quick back to Brendan's case, and, you know, I mentioned we use some of these examples in our training, among other cases and examples. I tell Marty's story all the time. Most, if not all, investigators identify the same thing when they watch these tapes. And I don't know the investigators that were involved in Brendan's case. I don't know their mindset at the time. But when I talk to investigators today, when they reflect back, I'm sure they wish they would have done things differently, even just because of the reliability or unreliability that comes from those statements and the approach that was used. And I think that's powerful. You know, we've got investigators across the globe that recognize there's an issue with the reliability of that information. And as Laura said, that's the information that was used to convict. And so we've got a simple math problem here.
Yeah, that's shocking. So what is the solution? A lot of what is being done, I think it's generous to say that it's confirmation bias. I think it's generous to say that it's tunnel vision. I think that there's just a lot of, I don't care. I've got somebody in the box here and my job's to get a conviction. I'm going to get a conviction. I've worked with so many of these prosecutors who have just told me straight up, I came over here, A, to get experience in front of a jury, and B, to build up a one loss record, hopefully perfect. And then I'm going to jump to the defense side of the docket so I can then start recruiting these cases and say, hey, I was a prosecutor. I was your worst nightmare. I never lost a case. I know how to beat these cases because I've been on the other side. I think they've got an agenda. Some of these guys have an agenda. And then they're going to jump to the other side of the docket and try to get rich off of it. I think there's more larceny in their hearts than just simple confirmation bias. But what do we do? How do we fix this? What does the legislation need to call for?
Well, I can speak to the law enforcement piece of this. There's a slide I have in our PowerPoint that says, if it ain't broke, break it. And part of the first thing that we have to do when we're training investigators is identify they've used techniques for the last several decades that in their mind have been successful because they have successfully solved some cases. And so the first thing we have to do is educate what all of these potential tactics are that can be a problem. The second thing we have to do in conjunction with that is provide education on what training does work. You know, about almost a year ago now, my hometown of Buffalo, New York, we had a shooting, a racist attack at a grocery store. Sentencing was just about a week ago. We had 10 people in our community were killed. And if you have to go interview the witnesses to a shooting, you can't be relying on these deceptive tactics or assuming how they're going to respond. You need to understand how trauma impacts those witnesses. And the same thing applies in all of these cases, is providing a tool for investigators to go get information. From a legislative piece, the last third piece of this remedy is making sure not only policy and a department reflects new training, making sure that's bought in from the command staff top down, making sure the prosecutor's office knows what a reliable confession looks like. And if all that doesn't work, and it hasn't, we have to know that about 30% of wrongful convictions contained a false confession, which means about 30% of these had confessions that were admitted by the courts as voluntary. And so the important piece of legislation is to provide the courts a screening tool to identify, if all else fails, this shouldn't be used as evidence in a conviction against a potentially innocent person. So I think those are at least the three prongs that we're working on this side.
You know, I just throw one other thing into the mix here that I think another thing that surprises people, ordinary people, is the idea of prosecutorial immunity and police immunity. You know, I mean, for those of us who are just, you know, doing our jobs, living our lives, you make a big mistake at your job, or if you do something intentionally wrong at your job, you know, all of us can be held liable. People can sue us, right? I can get sued as a lawyer for malpractice. We can all get sued in different ways, held accountable for the things that we do wrong. But what's wild is that for police and prosecutors, it's not the same, right? They have been carved out of that system and given special immunity. So that if you are a prosecutor, and let's say you are a bad guy, and you decide to intentionally frame someone for murder, knowing that they're innocent, right? The worst of the worst of the worst things you can do, send them away to prison for life or maybe to death row, and you do this on purpose, you cannot be held liable under the law because of immunity, right? And police officers have qualified immunity that act to protect them, even if they do things intentionally wrong. And I think that's a huge part of the system that's got to be fixed too. We can all be held accountable to each other. And there's no reason to take a couple of groups of professions, police, prosecutors, and treat them different than doctors or teachers or, you know, other important people with important responsibilities in our society.
Yeah, I think we're all three saying the same thing. Think about how many interrogations go on, how many interviews or interrogations, however somebody approaches it, go on every day. I think the vast majority of them don't have ill intent. I think they're trying to get to the truth, get to the bottom, find out what happened, and hold the right people accountable. I'm a huge supporter of law enforcement from the bottom to the top. But man, when you get something that goes awry, I think depriving someone of their liberty in the United States is a very high standard, and it should be. Depriving someone of their life is the highest of high standards, and well, it should be. There's got to be some kind of standard, some kind of review, check and balance system here. And having spent so much time in the litigation arena, I've told my staff here, if you get stopped, you get in juxtaposition to some crime, you don't want to say anything about anything to law enforcement. You need to get a lawyer and don't say anything. Frank Luntz, who has been a guest on this podcast, is a USC professor and president of Frank I. Luntz & Associates, a survey research and consulting firm. Now, when he was on recently, he invited me over to his house for a focus session with a group of USC students. Half of them identify as Republican or at least right-leaning in their political views, and the other half identify as Democrat with a real left-leaning, more liberal view, and there are a few independents in between. And he asked me if I wanted to participate in that to see if we could talk about how to eliminate or at least improve on the divisiveness between these two sides and get them to maybe communicate in a more productive way. I said, well, you better not ask me if you don't want me to show up. And I did show up. We spent several hours with these bright, intelligent, articulate, passionate young people on both sides. And by the way, it was a Friday night with college kids in Los Angeles. And they cared enough to take their Friday night in LA to come over to this professor's house and sit down and go through this.
How many of you were punished by a professor or canceled by a club, something significant, because your point of view was not the same as the professor's point of view or the same as a group of students' point of view? Who's actually faced it in this room? Raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Same number of Republicans and Democrats. 5 Republicans, 4 Democrats. So what's the problem?
The example of the bill in Florida denying all government, all the state advantages that Disney had. I think it's a difference when a company is using, where they're getting, they're essentially living in Florida's house. They give them a seat in the house, and then they're going to go in to interfere with something that actually isn't even based out of their state. It's a California company. So guess what? You go ahead and bite the hand that feeds you. It's going to pull back. I don't consider that canceling. I consider it, hey, you know, get what you got going to you.
So you started to laugh at him, which is something that Yugal mentioned before. I know he wasn't telling a joke. Why were you laughing?
No, I was laughing at Christian's enthusiasm.
Corporations should not be retaliated against for expressing views on issues by government actors financially in order to corral them onto their side in a culture war.
Which you used to believe. This is a Republican point of view that a Democrat is articulating.
I am saying that having the Lieutenant Governor of Florida go on the air and openly admit it's a quid pro quo of them breaking from the Republicans on this issue and then having Disney be punished by the Republican Party for expressing a socially or culturally different view in order to threaten other companies into falling in line with them. That type of regulation comes straight out of platforms similar to the Italian fascist platform. Absolutely.
Do you actually mean that?
It's an
Italian fascism.
Italian fascism.
Is that the words you want to say in a discussion like this? Or do you want to take it back? I'm asking you a specific question, Italian fascism. I'm a language guy. Do you want to accuse them of that? Yes or
no? No, it was a simile. I didn't say it was.
You said it was like
it. It is illiberal and goes against free exchanges of ideas.
Then why did you use that term?
Because corporatism is used historically by Latin American fascist governments.
Once again, with the fascism term.
I'm not saying this as an insult.
You used that phrase, did you not? We can play the tape back.
I didn't call him a fascist.
You said it was like fascism, like Italian fascism.
Yeah, I'm sticking by it. My point is correct. I'm saying that policy is similar to policies that were in, for example, the Italian fascist platform, meant to corral the business community onto one political side.
If you got something to say to him, say it. Stop doing it through him. How do you want to respond to him? Go ahead.
As someone who's not a part of either the USC GOP or the Democratic Club, like, I know Dr. Phil, big fan, by the way. I know that you said that you found this to be respectful, but for me personally, like, to use Colby's word, this is kind of horrifying. Like, this doesn't seem to be like a politics issue. It seems like you guys just fundamentally don't like each other as people. It seems like this is going beyond your political beliefs and is really being like an assault on both sides of your characters.
Is this not an example of passion?
No, it goes beyond passion. I'm confident in that. I know what I'm saying.
Do you buy this?
By the way, I said that before we started using similes like Italian fascism.
There's no point to using words like that on both sides other than trying to get your point across.
Why do you think people on this side are this passionate or post-passionate to the point of like what you believe is aggression and anger? And I fully will believe and understand that because, yeah, some of what's happened to you, what you've been explaining, sounds fucking horrifying. Sorry. It's horrifying. And that sucks. But why do you think people have this response towards conservative politics when we feel the exact same way about conservative politics, that we feel that we're getting this response from conservative people?
I don't think it's so much a political issue. Like, yes, politics got radicalized on both sides, yes. But it's a generational issue. We have the attention span worse than a goldfish. People cannot even watch a 15-second TikTok. I'm surprised everyone is still here, right? How can people actually engage in a conversation that, you know, it's for 2 hours if we can't even watch a 15-second TikTok? It's a generational issue.
I think that this conversation has brought out some of the worst in both sides
in vocabulary, but also just in both sides are getting pretty riled up, right? And that's just not my experience with Republicans on campus. And I really hope that that's not your overall experience with Democrats on campus. I mean, I hope. I think I'm getting to know everybody and I'm feeling a lot more empathetic towards your point of view.
Can I respond to that?
But I want Dr.
Oh, yeah, let Dr. Phil go first.
I'm wondering, are you trying to win an argument, make your point, and get it across, bang, 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 or are you trying to solve a problem, reach a common ground? Because I felt like for a while there was some problem solving going on, and then I think it deteriorated into trying to win an argument.
Were you trying to win an argument or were you trying to solve a problem?
I think we try to win arguments as part of trying to solve a larger problem.
His point is important. The best thing that you all have done on this side is that you ask questions, because that will both, through the question, you get a better understanding of where they come from. And in the way that you frame the question, you're boxing them in a little bit. So you're doing both at the same time, but you're giving them the chance to be heard. And on your side, there are several of you who are really reaching out to that side, who are trying to find that common ground because there's a humanity. My life is about conflict resolution now. And I believe that we are far worse today because of our previous president, and I now say so publicly, because he never saw a conflict. He didn't want to engage and provoke and make much, much worse. And there was a time when I didn't want to say that because I did not want to get the shit of him and all the people who support him, and it just wasn't worth it. And then I realized the damage that he'd done to you all. There are several people over here. You want them to feel what you felt, but you want to punish them for what you felt, as opposed to establish empathy. We don't spend enough time trying to walk in each other's shoes. We don't spend enough time trying to learn each other's challenges. You have been blessed with instant information, instant friendships, instant everything across the globe. And what do? You find a reason to beat each other up.
But don't we forget that there are people behind these beliefs? Everybody's been sitting for a long time. Can we do like a 2-minute exercise? Let me tell you, here's what I want you to do. I want people to pair up in what I call a standing dyad. And there's a rule to this. There can be zero small talk. You can't say anything. Let me have you. And I'll use you as an example. Come right here. And let me have you. Right here. Come on. Okay, this is a standing dyad. You can't say a word. I just want you to get right here and make eye contact. You're in each other's personal space. We got left and right. I just want you to make eye contact. Don't say anything. Just look at each other. Now, everybody on the left, everybody on the right, find a partner. No, don't talk. Just find a partner and get in a standing dyad like this. Okay. Just make eye contact. Don't say anything. Look each other in the eye. Don't look away. We don't do this enough. And obviously, I'm leaving you here. This is the ultimate pregnant pause. And you probably haven't looked anybody in the eye this much for a long, long time. And realize you're looking at another human being. They have parents. Brothers, sisters, they get up in the morning, they have to decide what to wear, they have to decide what they're going to do. They have fears, prides, thoughts, feelings, just like you do. Okay, A, tap B on the shoulder. There's just two of you, you'll work it out. A, tap B on the shoulder. Okay, now, when I say go, and not until I say go, A, I want you to say one of four things. You're going to say, I trust you, I don't trust you, I don't know if I trust you, or I'd rather not say. Go. All right, B, go. Okay, all right, hold on. Okay, no talking.
If you are a Republican, if you are on the right side of the room, raise your hand. All right. You on the left, find a new partner right quick. Lefts, find somebody with one that's got their hand in the air. All right. You should now have a new partner. Somebody from the left and somebody from the right. Make eye contact. Look this person in the eye. Consider them as a human being. When I say go, A, I trust you, I don't trust you, I don't know if I trust you, or I'd rather not say. A, go. All right, B, go. Okay, if you're from the right, raise your hand. Left, find a new partner one more time. Eye contact. Consider this person. I mean, really. Don't just go through the motions. Just think about this person. What did they go through today? Have they lost a loved one lately? Are they having financial trouble? Have they accomplished something great lately? Are they lonely? Did they just get engaged? All right, B, your turn. Go. All right. Okay, everybody have a seat. Well, that's just a real simple little experiential exercise. First off, without any structure, what was your reaction? What did you experience?
When you were asking the questions about what did they do this morning? Did they lose a loved one? Like all these questions that you might be asking about yourself and things that you might really consider important to yourself, you realize that there's someone behind these political ideals, someone that may be dealing with issues that you yourself might be dealing with. And it's not all just about what we disagree on.
I completely agree with you. I think I felt very connected. Wasn't even considering their affiliation or their identity. I just saw a human being and had that empathy.
It also made me think that it's a lot harder to say you don't trust someone to someone you're looking straight at, whereas it's so much easier to hide behind a screen and kind of assume things about people when you're looking at them in the face and kind of thinking about these questions, like seeing them as a person. It's a lot different.
Yeah.
When you were asking me to look at this person and view them as a human being, it was something that I already knew what to do. But at the same time, I also realized that I sometimes personally forget to do that.
Yeah. How about you?
I just saw everyone as a human. Before you ask those questions, you know, and my partners that I had, they can testify to this. It was just, we looked at each other, we laughed. You know, there was no tension. There was no, oh, I wanna strangle this person. Not that I ever feel that way. I'm just saying, like, it can get to that extreme, right? If we're pushed to those limits. But here I was with a stranger, laughing, smiling.
How'd you decide who was A or B?
I just went for it.
Yeah. Okay, I wanna know, how many of you were A three times? Three times. Okay, look at this. You guys need to be a little bit more humble. You guys need to be A's a little bit more often. But that's for me a holy shit finding.
Yeah.
And I want to try this with all of America. Watch what's going to happen. I'm going to get arrested by going around A, touch B.